Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with Merkage Dave, and it's an absolute belter of a chat. He's got some energy, man, and we have a lovely chat, and it goes all over the shop, musically, and yeah, you're in for a treat with today's episode. Before we get on with it, a few thank yous. First of all, always the biggest thanks go to you lot for continuing to listen to Off the Beaten Track, and yeah, give us your support and your social media likes and shares. So big love to yous. Also, always like to thank Mr. Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Go check the network out. This podcast is super proud to be part of it. Big thanks to my mate Tom for facilitating this episode. Thanks loads, mate. And thanks to 76 for producing the audio to ensure today's natter sounds nice and good. Okay, also, if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, welcome. But when you finished listening to my chat today, go check out the back catalogue because you've got 400 episodes available now. And you can hear me chatting to artists as diverse as producer Butch Vig, producer Fatboy Slim. You can hear me talking to Chuck D of Public Enemy. You can hear me talking to incredible acting talents like Maxine Peake, Joe Hartley, Thomas Turgoose. Comedians, you can hear me talking to James Acaster, Maisie Adam, Ed Gamble. Yeah, there's so many episodes for you to get stuck into. Artists such as Foo Fighters, Motley Crue, Suede, Idols, Sleaford Mods. The list is endless. Go and have an explore, and I'm sure you'll see some artists that you'll go, oh, I'd be quite interested to hear what records have made their minds tick throughout their creative journey. And if that's not enough, then you can get loads more content, and you can get... Well, you can watch all the episodes for one, and that's over on my Patreon. So you can get like weekly DJ radio shows, Spotify playlists. Like I say, you can watch all the episodes. And there's a back catalogue of 300-400 episodes over there. And that will cost you $1 a month. So what's that? 70p a month. And that 70p, essentially, you're just supporting the podcast and helping me sort of pay for all the bits and pieces to ensure that I can continue to give two episodes a week for free. So yeah, if you can dig deep, I know times are tough, man, and the cost of living is ridiculous, but yeah, if it's if that's a lot of money in your current budget, no worries, just go and enjoy all the free shit. Otherwise, if you can spare 70p a month to support the podcast, it would be absolutely delightful of you. Anyway, that's enough of the hard selling. Everything you need to know about this podcast, by the way, is at www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Anyway, I know why you're here. Please enjoy today's episode of Off the Beat and Track Podcast with the delightful Merkage Dave. Right, I've got to take a quick break in this podcast because I've got some super exciting news. Off the Beat and Track Podcast is proud to go into partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. That's right. The Cacao Bar is not a chocolate bar. It's all the best bits of a chocolate bar put into a really exciting new alcoholic range. That's right. Gin, vodka, and a beautiful range of cream liqueurs. So one of the big bonuses of this partnership is obviously I'm super thrilled to have Hotel Chocolat working with us, but they sent me a great big box of this stuff. And I'm telling you, it's amazing. Go and check it out, www.hotelchocolat.com or over on the socials at Hotel Chocolat. But yeah, in the coming months, there's going to be opportunities for you to get involved with competitions with us, to win bottles of stuff. There's loads of exciting things coming soon, and I can't be more happy to say that this podcast is in partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. All right, let's get back to the podcast. It's Off the Beaten Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, we are recording. Dave, how are you today, mate?
Yeah, good, man. How you, Stu?
Yeah, well all right, mate. Well all right. Well, before we get into songs and your creative journey, I just want to touch on the creative process and journey and how that was over the last couple of years. So all of a sudden, when the world stops turning the way it was turning, everything kind of had to be readdressed and reset and looked at. Certainly with you know, most creatives, their process had to kind of revert to being maybe more DIY than it had ever been. Just talk me through the sort of 2 years of pandemic and how it affected you, but both personally and creatively.
I got pretty lucky, man. I'd come off tour end of 2019, and I was always going to be making an album. Luckily, as a lot of friends had like their whole schedules like messed about and stuff, I was lucky in that regard. And I've always kind of like made music out of kind of like makeshift studios, staying on people's sofas and all that stuff. So I was kind of like, I got very lucky. I was prepared for it. I think that, I was planning to travel a lot. And obviously, like, I managed to get out to Copenhagen the beginning of 2020. And I think maybe, did I go Berlin before that? But everything else just got thrown out the window. And it was just like, yeah, like, every day in the back room of our flat, just going in. But actually, I ended up being more productive than I'd ever been. I think I wrote the most amount of songs in a period of time that I've ever written. And I had all the song names there and like all the kind of concepts I had in my head. So it kind of like, I would say that it wasn't the most like fun writing process, but it was kind of like necessary. I think it was kind of like, I don't know, like it is what it is. You just react to the circumstances you're in.
Did you put pressure on yourself, Dave? Like knowing, right, okay, look, touring's not going to be happening for the foreseeable. Like, I've got this time now where theoretically you can't leave your home. Like, did you feel a pressure put upon yourself that, like, right, I need to max this time and like utilize it?
At first, no, because it was just like there was just like a novelty in it, so it's just like, I was just getting like mashed up, just making like Long Island iced teas like every day.
It was airport late. Rules, wasn't it, when it first started? Yeah. It was like, it's exactly 10 o'clock in the morning, let's have a beer.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I was definitely on. But I just realized quickly that this was not going to really run. And I think, like, you know, I was getting like, it's weird. I started getting like the jitters, you know, like my hands would be like shaky, like I don't know, it's weird kind of like physical anxiety that I started kind of getting. So I had to kind of like, I guess because I was like psychologically, I was worried about making the album and doing it in this kind of like way. But so I just sorted it out. I just started exercising in the mornings and just kind of like, it was weird, like almost like treating it like a job in a way. Like, so even though like it was like hyper creative, I would never force myself to like kind of like hit a target each day or anything like that. But just like in terms of the amount of time that I spent doing it, even if I was sitting there and looking at the screen and not doing anything, I would just like almost like treat it like
sure,
like a job. And then if I had to go over, I would obviously go over. But like yeah, I almost like had like a, almost did it like a 9 to 5 and then just like try to like relax my mind in the evenings, you know.
Okay. Well, let's start your playlist. And for track one, I'm going to ask you, please, to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Yeah, man. So this is Jay-Z, The Ruler's Back, which opens up the Blueprint album, one of my favourite. I say maybe my favourite Jay-Z album. It's hard to say. Depends what week you catch me on.
Yeah.
Legendary album that came out, I think, the same week that like September the 11th happened.
Mm.
So it was kind of just like a mad time. I mean, just like musically, I think it's Just Blaze on this one. I know Kanye did produced half of the album, and Just Blaze produced half. I think this one's Just, and it just kind of musically, the way it opens. I mean, Jay-Z's got some amazing intros to a lot of his albums, but just, I don't know, just the kind of tension is just incredible musically. But also, like, I think one of the things that wows me is that like a lot of his verse is like an interpolation of a Slick Rick record that's also called The Ruler's Back.
Yeah.
And so it's like he's kind of like, it's amazing how he's managing to kind of like touch on all this stuff that's to do with him, that's to do with the current times. But he's, and I don't know, it's just that blend of, like kind of going back against people that are trying to like detractors and people that are trying to stop him, or legal issues, and but then also talking about like political stuff, social stuff, but then putting it within the framework of another record.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Jay-Z's very good at doing that, I think, like cementing himself in the lineage of like the great storytellers, the great writers, if you go back and if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to the Slick Rick version as well, and you'll be like, wow, like, the way he did that is like amazing, you know?
Yeah. Talk me through your creative process when it comes essentially to the intro. Do you have considerations for getting on Spotify playlists? You know, you see with more, I guess, commercial pop music that, right, you know, no fat on this, it's got to be like straight in with a big chorus, hook 'em. Like, does any of that kind of, you know, the fact that the way that people consume music now is you know, it's far, that there's far more stuff out there than maybe back in the day when you could only afford like a couple of CDs or a couple of records a week or whatever, you know, that you've got everything there and you're flooded with new music. Like, and so, you know, do you know what, Dave? I've asked this question 400 times now on this podcast, and I've still never framed it right. I still can't get it right where I'm trying to go with it. There's so many trends in music that kind of, in a way, take the art out of music, but then it's an art form in itself to create the perfect pop record as well. I just want to know what kind of things influence your creative process when you're writing, and essentially the intro. Do you get where I'm going with the question, Dave?
No, I totally understand the question. I think that technology does change the way that, I mean, I don't think about it like in terms of like my songwriting, but I think sometimes subconsciously these things do affect you. I think that, like, you know, like even like the idea of the 3.5 minute pop song, someone told me that that's actually to do with like when singles were being released on vinyl, it was the optimum amount of time.
That's correct.
For the thickness of the vinyl that they could use and stuff like that. So we just think of it as it's always been that way, or it was like that was the kind of amount of attention that a person could have on it. But it was actually a technology reason. So I guess like what you're looking at in this time is the same thing. I mean, I definitely don't like deliberately, I don't think about Spotify playlists at all, because I haven't really, I feel like I get a lot of my plays just from people repeat playing something that they're like, there's a message there for them that they're emotionally attached to. And I, you know, that's kind of like why I write music, you know? So I don't really like think about like playlists. I think like, when you say intro, do you mean an intro to an album or just a song? Because like I think like that's
Yeah, I mean, rather than it being sort of something more sort of conceptual about an album, I think, you know, just a track.
Yeah, it depends how it feels, I think. I'm trying to think about it, like, if on my last album or in this album, there's certain songs, like, so, like, my song, World I Want to Live In, I come straight in, do not read the comments. That's the first thing that I say before the first note comes in before any music is played. But it's because I felt like that was kind of like the impactful thing that I wanted to, like, that's how I wanted to arrest people straight away. Whereas like a song like, say like another single that I put out, Us Lot, there's like a instrumental like opening before the beat drops in and then the vocal drops in on the beat. I think it's to do with, I think most musicians would like to feel like that it's more just like organic. And I definitely, I'm trying to, it's a really interesting question because I'm actually trying to think about it honestly. And I think that, like, I don't actively think about it, but I guess, like, there'll be loads of factors that, you know, like, if you listen to a lot of modern music, the structures of these songs do start to kind of, like, bleed into your own process and stuff like that. And it depends as well, like, you know, like, the opening of a club record is different to the opening of, or, like, an acoustic record is...
Yeah.
I don't know if I've really given you a clear answer, but...
The question weren't very clear, so it's good that the answer was the same. All right, well, let's take you back for track two, and I'm going to ask you please to tell me the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
Okay, cool. So, 3T, anything, man.
Talk me through it, man.
Yeah, for those that don't know, man, because I was thinking about this, I was like, was it Boyz II Men? It might have been a Boyz II Men one, but I feel like 3T, for like the age that I was, and just like that they were. I remember, obviously, for those that know, they're Michael Jackson's nephews, you know, same nose and everything. But like they were like always on, like, I think it was like CD UK,
yeah,
or like, and like I think they were on Top of the Pops and all that stuff. And I remember, like, they used to, like, wear, like, backpacks on stage. And I remember, like, one time they did a performance and one of them just started crying, like, mid-performance on television. And I don't think I'd ever seen something like that before. I mean, looking back, it's like, I don't know. I mean, you know, in terms of, like, the kind of, like, the R&B kind of, like, tapestry, it's not a record that kind of gets brought up as much as a kind of like a standout. But I do think actually it really had a moment and it really kind of like owned the time that it was in. And I went back and listened to it and I think it's held up well. I think that first 3T album, like the musicianship on it and the arrangements is like really kind of like rich. Like they weren't messing about. So it's kind of like a semi-guilty pleasure, but actually like... You know, like sometimes you go back, you want to go back and see, is that embarrassing or,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And actually, it was like better than I would have given myself credit for at the time, yeah. If you see what I'm saying. And actually, it was kind of sick.
Yeah. What was the emotion?
I guess like, just kind of like melancholy, sadness, longing. You know, just traditional kind of like R&B,
yeah,
like slow jam emotions, man. And I was, you know, when I was growing up, I was definitely like on that side of things, you know, like a kind of soul boy, sweet boy vibe. So definitely, yeah, appealed, even though like I hadn't really been through, like one girl probably had dumped me in the playground and that was it. But do you know what I mean? I was
that shit hurts though, man.
Yeah, it does. To be fair, those ones are probably the worst ones. You know, they're probably the worst ones.
More importantly, what the fuck was in them backpacks?
Boy, that's a good question.
They've not taken their sandwiches to Top of the Pops, man. Like,
that is a good question. I think 3T, if you're out there and you're listening, this is the answer that the people, yeah, wanna
yeah
wanna know, man.
We want to know the actual baggage. Let us know what was in it. Surely that was pre-laptops. Were laptops a thing then? I don't know.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, this was like, I mean, we had a computer in the house that was like a Packard Bell, like 386.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think this was even before like Pentium, bro.
Yeah.
I think it might have been like the first Pentium chip. Like it was, it was like MS-DOS era, yeah. Bruv. Like there was no social media. Television was the thing, you know. And they were like, yeah, they just had that moment with that, I think it was like mid-90s.
Yeah.
And they were just running it. I think they did the business in the UK. Yeah. For a couple of years,
you know? Well, they were all good-looking boys, weren't they? Like, so yeah, they got thrown in with like the sort of boy band thing as well, didn't they? Like, there was all of that going on in the mid-90s as well. And I think, like, and you know, they come from, you know, pretty good stock. You know, if your mum and dad are Jacksons, then you've got musical bones. Like,
yeah, may as well get it popping, man. Like, makes sense. Yeah, I think the boy band thing is really interesting because, like, yeah, the kind of dynamic between you had like there's like New Kids on the Block and stuff, but then really before that you had New Edition.
Mm.
I think like New Edition were like obviously like Bobby Brown was in New Edition and stuff. That was like a bit before my time. Obviously, like I went back and listened to all the stuff, but. Like, I don't know, just like super influential, just that kind of like dance between the R&B boy bands and the pop boy bands. It was kind of like that was the thing, I think.
Well, I caught that. I'm 49, so when okay. Candy Girl come out, like that was on the first ever record I bought was the first ever Nair compilation, and Candy Girl was on it, and it's obviously such a brilliant pop song. Like I was all over it, and then I think the second single was like Mr. Telephone Man, I believe. And then like that was it. I didn't think of New Edition again, and then all of a sudden, people were like, "Yeah, but like Bobby Brown, he was in New Edition." I was like, "Really?
Yeah.
I wonder what the other guys are up to." And then it was like Bell Biv DeVoe.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And it was like
Poison,
fucking hell, yeah. Poison. What a fucking tune that is, man!
Like, it just lasted forever. Yeah. You know, it's funny, like, I seen, like, I think it was, like, a Kanye interview, and he said that ended up being the most, like, successful New Jack Swing song, even though it was kind of, like, a copy of a Teddy Riley vibe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I find that kind of interesting, you know, that sometimes, yeah, I don't know. Or, you know, like Marvin Gaye got to Give It Up, it was like he was taking the piss out of disco.
Yeah.
Or like his label had wanted him to make a disco record, and he just did, and then it ends up being. I just find that really interesting. Sometimes the motivations for making a record, and then where they end up, you know.
But yeah, I think Marvin Gaye was just a fucking maverick with shit like that. Obviously, probably the most, you know, I guess daring record ever. It's well documented, like, you know, that Berry Gordy was not into what's going on. And like,
oh yeah, yeah. And I mean just, that changed music forever. Like, you know, in terms of the idea of like soul music being political, you know,
and a concept album.
Yeah. Right. It just like, you know, Berry Gordy, yeah, like you're saying, he's trying to stop it from happening. He's like, this is not what Motown's about. We're not trying to like rock the boat, we're trying to sell kind of like black music to like mainstream, you know, Western white audience, and then he's like coming out criticizing the government, criticizing, you know, some issues that we're still dealing with today, like, you know, like the environment and, you know, all this kind of stuff, like anti-war message. But it does so well commercially. No
one can selling album
shit
in the history of Motown.
yeah. So no one can say shit to him, and then you get like. Because no one was writing on, I guess it was only Smokey that was writing on,
yeah,
for himself, and then Stevie starts writing for himself, and then you get that whole run in the 70s where he's just like, wow, like that's my favorite run of any artist, yeah. I think, is Stevie Wonder in the 70s, and then actually ultimately you get the Jackson 5 leaving Motown because they won't let them write, and then they go to Epic, and then you get all of that stuff, so it's like. man, like, but that album is one of the most pivotal albums in pop music history.
It's my favorite album by a mile. It's like, I don't think you can ever listen to that and just think, oh, do you know what would have sounded good there? Ain't going to happen. It's fucking perfect. There's no... It's just perfect. And it's just such a... And I don't want to sound like some middle-aged old man, which I am, but it is such a fucking journey, that record. And like, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful record. And yeah, I'm a ridiculous fan anyway, but like, for me, just in music alone, whatever mood I'm in, up, down, whatever, you put that record on and I'm lost in it. Absolutely, yeah, 100%. Lost in it.
I think a big part of that is the kind of way that it kind of... I don't even look at it as like... Obviously, you've got the standout songs on it, but when I listen to it, I don't look at it as like a collection of songs. I look at it as one piece of music. Yeah. And I think that like the impact of that, even like... You know, we're talking about Jay-Z Blueprint album. You can hear when you listen to that album sonically, the way it's like rich and it flows. There's definitely like an influence. Like people definitely, you know, any album you can think of where like there's a whole body of like it kind of runs like almost like a score. Mm-hmm. Like they've gone back and listened to what's going on. That's like the one.
Yeah.
Maybe also like I would say like Pet Sounds for me is
100%.
One. That like also has
that's my number,
that
that's my number
of,
two.
Right, okay, so we're on the same wavelength. Yeah. But like those are even like you listen to like a Kendrick album or
go back even to like 3 Feet High and Rising, De La Soul. That whole album is a concept. It literally flows from start to beginning. Interludes all the way through that hold it together, like what's going on. It's like incredible. Absolutely incredible. Go on, sorry, man. I jumped. I got overexcited then.
No, it's cool.
And you talk about Kendrick.
No, wait. I just said, whether you want to look at Kendrick or Tyler the Creator, I think that like it's all in the legacy of that record. I think of that. I guess that time, you know, and that those two records that we mentioned are definitely two that kind of. I don't know, shape the way. And I still try and, like, with my own stuff, I think... I feel like a lot of, you know, people say, you know, we're talking about how technology has changed the trends. But for me, I think an album's still important as, like, a kind of an artistic statement. And cohesion, like, the track order. Even for me, like, the amount of seconds in between a song... you know, that's something that me and Kors, who like exec produces my albums with me,
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So you look at, you know.
Okay. Let's stay in the formative years. Track three, the song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Okay, there was a lot here, man, that I was thinking about because it's like, you know, it's like I was thinking of Fugees, of, you know, Dr. Dre, but I feel like I landed on Oasis, She's Electric, because I guess like it was like a time where like, I guess back then things, and this is one of the cool things about now, is that like I feel like there's less tribalism musically now.
I totally agree.
And back then it was like, if you were like more of a soul R&B boy, or I was kind of getting into UK garage as well. So like guitar music was like the enemy, kind of, which is silly because actually soul and indie is, obviously a bigger conversation, but I actually think it's the same genre. But like, it's like at that time I was like, I didn't really rate a lot of guitar stuff, but I couldn't deny Oasis. It was like that, you know, those albums, and it the songwriting was so good, and it was just like, it was just everywhere, and it was just like, I just remember like people singing that song. Obviously, I think there's Oasis songs that like I prefer, but like that song, I just remember everyone like singing it in the corridor at school.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? And so it kind of lands me. When I hear it, it just lands me back in a place. You know?
Yeah. That period of Oasis, like that Morning Glory album, like I think, I'm sure he'd admit it himself, but like he was at his creative peak, Noel Gallagher, there. Like, yeah. I look at it, and with like the singles, like Some Might Say, like he was using the track like Acquiesce as a B-side. And there's indie bands then that would have given their right arm to have had that as their crowning moment. And he was throwing them on B-sides. And it's like, that's how cocky and confident he was in his output at that point. There was no stopping him. And I've run an indie nightclub for 30 years. And I've watched these different tribes all come and go. And then in 1994, I guess, when Oasis exploded, and then it just went again with the whole Blur Oasis rivalry thing with that record. Yeah. I saw the demographic change in indie clubs all of a sudden.
All right.
Moved. Because then, Dave, you'd have like, you know, Nirvana had happened, and like previous to that, the Stone Roses and the Manchester thing had happened. But it was all still very, a bit underground, and it was all a bit, your average guy on the street would be like, who's them scruffy weirdos making that noise?
Yeah, yeah.
And then all of a sudden, these two brothers come out writing essentially great pop records.
Exactly, yeah.
Talking about football, fighting, fucking, and all of a sudden, the guys in the football terraces are like, I like these guys. And then before you know it, they're buying Blur records, they're buying Suede records and Pulp records, and then they're turning up at indie clubs, and it just blew it open. And I remember Noel Gallagher said, when I walked out on the first night of playing Nebworth with Oasis, I looked out and I thought, I think I fucking killed the indie scene. Like, that underground scene, he took it to the masses. And, it, you know, at that point, yeah, of course there was garage, and of course there was so much other music going on, but I reckon 95, 96, around that time of that Blur Oasis thing, guitar music was the biggest thing coming out of the UK. It was ridiculous. For sure. Like,
At that point, yeah. And that's a really interesting thing, actually, because I was a bit too young to see that. But obviously, I've been a club promoter as well. And those kind of things, seeing that, I never thought about that, you know, that, because my association, you know, like a guy in a football shirt.
Yeah.
I will associate him, I guess, because there was so much stuff that came after that, whether you want to talk about Kasabian or whatever, but it's like, that guy in the football shirt, I would always have associated him with guitar music. There's no period where I would have thought that they looked at it as a bit. But then, if you want to look at, like the kind of Seattle stuff or.
But that never got the tag. Stuff, that never got the lad culture tagged to it. Oasis did. They were lads. And that's what really sold it.
That's like fascinating. I love stuff like that, man. Like, you know, like when you just like see like there's a piece that just kind of like fits, and it helps you understand music, but also just like British popular culture. Like I watched, like during the pandemic, I watched a documentary about Style Council, and that just like,
how good was that?
Wow, like it just blew my mind, because it kind of like made me see like a whole, like I say, because I wasn't like into guitar music until like really the noughties. So it was like, it kind of opened my eyes to like a kind of like again, like that legacy, that kind of like of no, because obviously like Style Council, I wouldn't count them as like a guitar band, but just like almost just like the kind of like there's like a line between, I guess, like Style Council, Happy Mondays, and the Streets. And I never looked at it like that. So like I got into the Streets through UK Garage, and I never, you know, and obviously like I ended up going on tour with Mike and stuff, but it was like, and you got this element of the audience, and that kind of didn't look at it like rap music, or didn't look at it like garage or whatever. And I was always kind of confused by that. But then there's this other kind of line that it's connected to that I didn't realize, you know, like a political kind of dapper dressing, kind of, I guess, like from that, like a mod revival, and then kind of like poetry over American US club beats. You know, it's kind of crazy when you start to see these things, and it just, I think every time I get one of these kind of like, you've just given me another one there. Do you know what I mean? Where it's just kind of like blow my mind, and it just helps me understand like British popular culture on a level that, yeah, I never thought of, it's a bit like when my mum told me, like my mum's Jamaican, and like my mum told me that like Rastas, obviously like over here, say, most of the exported, that the average person, the idea of Jamaica is like, it's kind of rooted in Bob Marley and then goes from there.
Sure.
But like my mum was explaining to me that Rastas, and when I went over there, I could kind of see that Rastas were like more like travellers, like what travellers are here.
Yeah.
And so they were like outside of society, and not the mainstream. And you've just showed me that again, like that the guitar thing, the indie thing wasn't, I've always associated it with lad culture. Obviously, yeah. I know there's obviously like degrees of it where it can be more kind of like left of that, but I've never thought of the idea of someone in a football t-shirt going, what's this shit? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's kind of blown my mind. So thank you, man. That's like, but you're probably going to get another album off me just from that.
But you say that about like the Streets, and the Streets definitely like transcended that. You know, the NME got hold of the Streets from day one as well, and they're selling that to indie kids, and it was like,
yeah.
Wow, what is this? And it's like, it was, and the same, and it's, I think it's that level of social commentary that you can just get hold of, that is essentially quite British. And I think that was something that, you know, Garage was so British. But I think Arctic Monkeys, that first album, them lyrics that first album, talking about young lads in tracky bottoms scrapping with like pool cues, it's like, we all know that. We all see that. That's where we live. And it's like, and I think again, that the fact that they just look like young lads in jeans and a tracky top, it was like, oh yeah, I get that. Whereas, you know, you look at a David Bowie, and I love David Bowie, but David Bowie looked like he was from outer space, and so that's a different world, do you know what I mean? That thing where you instantly just go, yeah, well, that's, yeah, I get that. And like, and God, like, you know, there's a Liam and Noel Gallagher in any pub you go to, do you know what I mean? There's always some brash guy in there, you know, that thinks he's got it all sorted. And like, and I think that's why just people just got onto, and the press obviously just run with it, because it was so different, and it was like, right, we've got this indie band that like fellas on football, you know, fellas in football terraces are going mad for, and like, so yeah, it definitely transcended it. But
and I think actually guitar music, you spoke about Arctic Monkeys. It's like they, I think like after Arctics, it's like, I think guitar music loses its way a bit and like kind of disappears up its own arse. I think it kind of like loses the contact with the street. And then, and also I think that resisting the changes in production, I think there's different arguments for whether that should or shouldn't have happened, but I think that effect, and then you kind of get the indie boys of the time end up doing, you know, whether it's like a, I don't know, like a James Blake or whoever, like they end up doing other things. But I kind of feel like it's back now. I mean, I kind of like, I really like Fontaine's DC. Like, I feel like they're kind of bringing that that energy, like that energy back, like that I think has been missing in guitar.
There's a sense of urgency in their music. Like, it just, it feels like they've got to fucking say this and get it off their chest. It's like, they're definitely one of the most exciting new bands out there. Well, they're not even that new now, I guess, but like, they're so exciting. Like, right, okay. This hopefully will be the embarrassing one. Track 4, the first song you remember buying from a record shop, please, mate.
Yeah, bruv. Spice Girls, Wannabe, bruv. Say it with my chest. I say it proud, man. No no fucks given, bro. But do you know what it is? And I was thinking about it. I was thinking, like, let me just say, because I had been given, you know, someone gave me a copy of Jungle Mania before that, but I didn't buy it. So I could have said Jungle Mania and it would have been
No one wants the cool answer, man.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? I could have said that and then got more points, but... Do you know what it is? I think there's something like, and it goes back to like my time, you know, my time in Jamaica, and like when I was over there, they don't have the idea of the guilty pleasure, and I found that like really liberating as a music fan, because you know you be in like a hardcore, like a dance hall. The DJ's just running straight dance hall, and then he'll just play like Wham, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go in the middle of the rave, and like everyone's going mad for that as well, and I found it kind of like really liberating. So when I came back to England, I kind of started moving with that thing, and it was like so now when I look back at stuff like this, it's something that I probably would have not admitted to before, but I think that there's something quite pure about like just really liking it. It's just a really well-written song. And also just like culturally, again, it just turned the key and like created like such a big moment in the kind of like in the tapestry of UK popular culture. But like I just responded to it as a child, was just like, I really like this. And I went to Our Price and I bought it on cassette. And that's kind of it really, you know.
I totally agree. I think like, I don't subscribe to a guilty pleasure. A pleasure's a pleasure, man. And it's like, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I listened to all sorts of, you know, pop music that I'm sure, you know, your chin scratchers are probably go, well, that's just shit. And I'm like, but if I hear it, it will trigger memories, smells, like all sorts. And it's like, and I like that, man. And you shouldn't feel guilty for that. Do you know what I mean? Nah, it's just like... Yeah. Oh God. You look at my Spotify playlist history. It's I'd say a lot of people would be like, "Fuck me, what is he listening to that shit for?" But like, but you know, if it makes you feel nostalgic, you know, I'm all over it. Like, I don't really see what the problem is. I think that's something that you maybe mature into a little bit. Do you know what I mean? I think you're so precious when you're young, aren't you? That like you don't want to be seen to not be cool, and you do everything. I think as you get older, you start to give a few less fucks, don't you? And it's like, well, hang on, I like this. Like, who cares?
Yeah, it's just so wrapped up in your identity. I mean, I remember, like, a few years later, like, literally, like, having a blazing row with someone about Artful Dodger being better than Nirvana. And it's just like, that's like the dumbest conversation. It's like, how can you even really like compare the music? It's just like, it was just basically like saying, I was basically saying to this person, and they were saying to me, like, my identity is, you know, and then we were just having an argument about identity.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that like, definitely, I think you're right. You kind of get to a point where it doesn't define you, and you're kind of a bit more like solid in who.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are, you know, but yeah. But yeah, man, yeah.
I remember, like, if like my pals were coming round, like when I lived, you know, when I was young, I was like a teenager living around my folks and that, and I'd have like, you know, my vinyl collection like resting against the wall, I'd always kind of have that last minute panic of thinking, oh fuck, which album should I put at the front?
Yeah.
What's my coolest record? Yeah. What do I want these girls to see when they walk
in? Yeah. I used to do the same thing, like when I was like. When I was at uni I got kicked out of uni pretty quickly, but I'd have like a CD rack in my like dorm or whatever, and I'd always make sure that the top albums were like the most cool, interesting albums.
So tragic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just like, do you know what I mean? It's a bit. I listened to like a podcast with you know, the artist Self Esteem.
Yeah,
and she was saying she was
like, that her on Scroobius Pips?
No, it was like. My brain can't load information at the moment. I'm like, it will come to me. But like, she was saying that she was like the kind of, you know, like the archetypal kind of cool indie girl. I think it was her. Do you know? I might be misquoting.
Yeah, because she was in Slow Club, I think, the band.
Yeah. But she was at home. She was listening to Beyonce, and not telling anyone. You know, and I find that. Really injured, and I think actually the turning point. I think that was the problem. I think that's where indie started having that problem of, like, because like for me, it's like, you know, if you look at like the Beatles or whatever, they were, you know, they started off doing covers of, you know, like Motown records and stuff. But then the fact that indie gets to a point where like you can't even admit that you listen to Beyonce,
yeah,
is kind of crazy. But then I think, funnily enough, I don't know if. I'm just kind of like, it was just the way that I observed it. But I think something about when Drake first came out turned the key again, and it was kind of like cool. I think maybe because he was more kind of like, he came at it at first on this kind of like, it was almost like Morrissey, do you know what I mean? Like where he was talking about like, you know, first world problems and like, I don't know, like admitting to like a lot of, I don't think he's not fully on that now, but like back then it was like,
Yeah,
it was kind of like, and I think that kind of like key, like kind of like turned the key with like indie heads to be like back in that thing. But I found that really funny that she said that, you know.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Right, I'm going to take you clubbing for track five.
Let's go.
The song that soundtracked your year's clubbing, please.
I mean, again, I thought about this a lot, but I would say that like, because I'm someone that like, I've loved going out. I've been going out since, like, I look super old. So, like, when I was, like, 13, I looked like I was 30. So, I've just been going out. I've been going out since then, and I still, you know, I don't go out as much now, but I still love going out when I can. And so, it's like, yeah, Roy Davis Jr. Featuring Pevin Everett, Gabriel, which is, like, has been the most, probably the most consistent record that I think the reason I've picked it is because it's one of my favourite ever songs, but also you'll hear it. I was hearing it from the first time I went out to if I go out tomorrow, I'll hear it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's like, it has to be the one that defines it then, you know, because it's lasted so long.
Where was clubbing?
I mean, I started off, I mean, you know, obviously I think we spoke before we started recording about, you know, you said you live in Essex. I think the first rave I went to was in Essex.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think it was, Atlantis.
Right.
And Epping Forest, man.
Yeah.
I remember, yeah, it was because I remember it was like MJ Cole was playing and like a load of people like Ramsey and Fenn. And I remember like, I feel like Artful Dodger, they were doing a PA of Woman Trouble. And Craig David wasn't on the flyer, but I had convinced myself that he was going to be there. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, in my head, I was like, Craig David's going to be there. And so I was like mad excited. But I remember I had my child's bus pass. I didn't know that they searched you on the way in. And so...
Oh, dear.
So I take out all my stuff with my friends, and then all my friends have gone in, and then she's like, the bouncer, she was like, what's this? And I was like, I tried to say that like I was just trying to get cheaper travel or something. I can't remember what I said, but she just didn't have it. But she said, you know what? I'll let you in tonight, but if you come back again, you're getting knocked. And like she was a woman of her word, because she let me in that night, but every time I went back, she was like, and that was the only place I couldn't get in, because I looked old enough to get in anywhere else, but she knew.
Yeah.
And so she'd be like, get out of here. But I remember that was...
And essentially, it's quite creepy. There's a 30-year-old looking man with a kid's bus pass in his pocket. That's quite weird.
But yeah, I was 13, man. I was 13, and that would have been my first rave, and I would have heard... Because that record is technically... People say it's like the first two-step garage record. And it's interesting because it's an American record. It's kind of like an American like gospel house record, really. But it's got the kind of the deep sub-low bass and the detached drums. So it kind of gets kind of counted as the first two-step record. But I would have heard it that night. And like I say, like it's just gone all the way through, you know, and it's just defined my, you know... Any club, any type of club as well, like you're going to hear that record, you know.
Okay, let's take you home. Favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
All right, cool, man. So, like, obviously, like, we bigged up the Gallaghers earlier, so I got to show some love to Damon as well, because I grew up in Leytonstone. I was born in Whips Cross Hospital, and Damon Albarn is obviously, like, one of the Leytonstone legends. So I've gone with Gorillaz, Demon Days.
Nice.
Yeah, man. Do you know what? I was actually, because I spent quite a lot of time living in Manchester, and I was actually in, basically, like, that Demon Days album, so I picked the Demon Days song, but that Demon Days album was first performed, and I think it was in its entirety with everyone that was featured on it, at the Manchester International Festival, at the Manchester Opera House. And I was in the choir for that run of shows. It was like five shows in a row. And that was like my first experience of...
That's incredible. Like
it was like I just got picked up. I was singing. I was like in Manchester just singing. And a guy that played drums in my one band that I was in, he kind of said, do you want to come and do this thing? I was like, yeah, definitely. We're getting paid. And it was like, it was sick. And I, you know, it was like my first experience with the entertainment industry. Like everybody who was on that album was there, man. It was like, apart from, I think Dennis Hopper was the only person that wasn't there. Like I met Ike Turner just before he died. De La Soul were there. Roots Maneuver, Nena Cherry. A slow dance with Nena Cherry at one of the after parties.
Fuck off, man. Like, when I set this podcast up, right, there weren't many people that were on my wish list, right? Johnny Marr's on that wish list. It ain't happened yet. Right. I literally messaged Nena Cherry for the third time last week. Man, I'm a 49-year-old guy at 16 years of age when she's on Top of the Pops doing Buffalo Stance. Fuck me, man. That shit mattered. Oh, my God.
Yeah, man. I mean, like, she definitely wouldn't have remembered it, but it was one of those things that, like, for me... It was big, but obviously, like, Damon Albarn is just like, you know, and you know, the mad thing that was my introduction to Sean Ryder. I didn't know who he was. So like I must have seen this, like, I must have seen this guy backstage, and he's just like, he's pretty mashed up, and I just kind of didn't want to talk to him. Do you know what I mean? And then like, I thought, who's this weird guy? Like, walked into our dressing room one time, and I was just like, who's this guy? And then I seen the ovation that he got when he walked on stage, and I was like, rah, like, what's going on here? And that was like, he had like a karaoke style teleprompter to and I guess it's not funny actually looking back at it, because I kind of like, now that I kind of like know more about him, it's not actually funny, but it was like, you know, it's there. He had to have it. I could see from behind the stage.
Yeah.
He had it on a teleprompter telling him when to say, it's there.
Well, if I'm right, it was meant to have been, it's there anyway. And he just, he got it wrong recording it.
That's what I'm saying. It just opened my eyes, because it was just like, raw, like my man doesn't know actually when to say the lyric.
Yeah.
And one night I remember the screens broke. And they had to restart the song. It was crazy, man. But I feel like that definitely opened my eyes to like the idea of like, even though he was kind of like, and I think he's kind of like a lot better these days, isn't he? But like, he wasn't really there. But the idea of his legend was so great that like just him walking on stage. And like, even if he just didn't get a lyric right, people would just like, that was the biggest moment of the night. Oh, we were in Manchester, innit? Yeah. So
I'll give you a quick Sean Ryder story, right? So he came and DJed my club in Essex, and and this was, he'd just come out of I'm a Celebrity. I think he'd won it, and he'd been and doing the jungle thing, and he come out, and I was, you know, you have to understand, at 16 years of age in 1989, the Happy Mondays were the coolest fucking thing on the planet.
Yeah.
And we've been playing Mondays records in my club forever. And it's like, I'm going to meet fucking Sean Ryder tonight. And he walks into the DJ booth and I was like, holy shit, it's Sean Ryder. And like, I went, hey, doing Sean? And I won't say what he said to me first, but I was like, no, I can't get that for you, man. I said, but Ella, do you want a beer? So I gave him this bottle of Bud. We was chatting, and I thought, I can't wait for him to open this record box, because in my mind, it was going to be stacked full of like Hacienda Gold, right? He opened up this little box and there was about six CDs in there, and like I think three of them were like classic Driving Gold, Free with a Sunday Express, and I was like, his record collection's three CDs from a fucking newspaper. I was like, Sean Ryder is consistently on point with the brand. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to fucking get mangled and just fucking brand that, he's on point constantly, right?
Yeah.
So he's got this beer, and I went, Sean, I went, like, this is my last track, you can follow it. And he went, what do you mean? I went, well, we're paying you a fucking load of money to DJ. He went, oh, I can't DJ. And I was like, and he gave me a CD, and he went, track six or whatever. And I was like, oh, okay, so I'm paying you thousands of pounds for me to DJ. All right. So I thought, go with it. So I've introduced him. Crowd's gone fucking mental. And I went, Sean, I said, if I play Step On, are you happy to go on the mic and just do a bit of Twisting My Melons, man, and just give it a little bit of it? He was like, yeah, definitely, man. I was like, wicked. So, like, fucking dang, 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 da, dang, da, dang, dang, dang. And it's all gone. And then he's just got the mic and he's going, Sean, I'm 30. And I was thinking, he's singing the wrong song. And like, he was singing Kinky Afro over Step On. And I was thinking, fucking hell, he delivers time and time again.
That's amazing. Like, but the thing is, because if that
more importantly,
the first bit,
no one could hear him. And I was like, what's going on? He's going, Mike's fucked. And then I had to look at one of my heroes, and he had the bottle of Bud in one hand and the mic in the other, and I had to explain that he was singing into the bottle of Bud.
That's amazing, man. But it's like that is what it's like, if you told me that story about someone else, like if you told me that story about, like, I don't know, like Phil Collins or something, it would just be kind of like embarrassing. But because it's him, it's like it just satisfies everything that we want.
And
I find it really interesting. I feel like there's like a real kind of like, I feel like the people that were working on that project at the time, I don't know the ins and outs of every producer or the engineers and stuff, but they did an incredible job, because basically they just let these men live what they were doing, and then they captured it in the, even like the directors, like you look at Kinky Afro video, or you know, like it's just like incredible. They just managed to kind of, and I kind of compare it a lot to like what people would call like I wouldn't call them this anymore, but like, you know, like kind of like mumble rappers, where like they're like, you know, sipping lean and like getting out of it in the studio and just freestyling, but it's the engineer that is kind of picking out the gold and structuring the record. And I kind of feel, I get the feeling that that was how a lot of those Happy Mondays work records. You know, you kind of like, you kind of capture the gold out of this kind of chaos and pin it down.
Because I think it was Martin Hannett that done all of them early productions. He was more fucked up than them.
Right, okay. So how, that's insane.
I've no idea.
Someone must have been sober. I refuse to believe that everyone was fucked. Like, someone must have been like, okay, let's put that bit there. Like, I've been in the studio when everyone's fucked up. Like, nothing gets done.
Yeah.
Like, it's just too, it's too far.
Yeah.
Someone has to pull it together, you know, but yeah.
All right. Well, look, this is the last track, and you get to be a tastemaker for this one, mate. And,
right.
And it's a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to hear.
Yeah, man, for sure. I mean, this was the easiest one to pick for me. This is like one of my all-time favourite songs, Do Angels Cry by Lyndon David Hall. Lyndon David Hall is a hugely, hugely influential on me. I would say, for those people that don't know who he is, I think that the probably the easiest cultural reference is Love Actually. You know, in The Wedding, when like they surprise him with the band, they do All You Need Is Love in The Wedding, that's Lyndon David Hall singing. But he's like, you know, in terms of like the kind of tapestry of British soul, he's like such an important, he was like our, you know, he's like before Craig David, before the kind of, I guess he was like our, I wouldn't say Maxwell, but like, you know, I just think
it's definitely a UK kind of Maxwell D'Angelo type thing. Definitely.
Yeah. And he's super, you can even hear, like, even to this day, my, this, he's so influential on my style of kind of like singing. And you know, I was lucky enough to like meet, you know, again, when I was like, you know, 15, 16 or whatever, I met him in a West End club once, and he was like super shy and all that, but sadly he died of Hodgkin's like in his early 30s, man. But like, I kind of feel like the song that people know of his the most is Sexy Cinderella, but I feel like Do Angels Cry is this, man, it's like I listen to it when I'm on tour. I just, you know, backstage before I go on, that's one of the records that I just kind of go to, and I just feel like I just want everyone to hear it. I mean, he should be like, you know, he should be like revered like people revere like Jeff Buckley or someone like that. It's kind of like I just think he's incredible, but I feel like he kind of missed the kind of social media wave, and he didn't have a big enough kind of like commercial hit, so he's not really like remembered in the way that I think he should be. But yeah, hopefully just even by like, even if you know, we can put a few people onto to him from this, I think it would be worth it, because you know, I think he's just an incredible influence on me, and just an incredible part of the British soul legacy, you know.
Well, we make it easy for people to go and explore it, because we put together a Spotify playlist to accompany the podcast with all your choices, and we're throwing some of the other tunes that we've chatted about. as 2022's gathering a bit of pace now, like, talk me through what you're looking forward to personally from the rest of this year, and what's going to be happening professionally.
Yeah, man, I'm just like super excited, bro. Like, it's like my album's, I guess maybe my album will be out by the time this airs, or it will just be about to come out. I'm doing like in-store at Rough Trade East, Fop Manchester. I'm really looking forward to just like meeting, you know, I've tried to do a few things over the past few months where I meet people that support me, and I really like doing that. And so I'm looking forward to meeting, you know, the people that are really making it so that I can actually like do this thing that I love, man. It's such a great exchange, I think, you know, between me and them, and I think I'm looking forward to like performing that music, and then I guess it's some stuff that I won't mention yet because I don't want to. I was gonna say some other stuff, but it's not announced yet, and you know, but obviously, like, I mean, it's pretty obvious that I'm gonna go on tour.
Yeah,
I think at some point, it's pretty obvious. So that's not crazy to say that.
Yeah. And if people want to kind of stay up to speed on releases, tour dates, everything, where's the best place to follow you?
Merkage Dave, MurkageDave, Merkage Dave everywhere, like whether you on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, wherever, like Facebook, or MurkageDave.co.uk.
Wonderful. Well, if it's cool with you, we'll tag you on all the posts when this episode comes
please,
out.
Man.
So,
thank you.
So people can go and explore more of what you do. Mate, I've had an absolute blast today. It's been so good talking records, man.
Yeah, and you've put me on to like like I'm gonna end up going down another like rabbit hole now. So thank you, man. This is what it's all about, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
So thank you.
Oh, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I will definitely come and say hi at the Rough Trade in-store, man.
Oh, yeah, please do, yeah.
There you go. What an absolute dude. Like, know when you just have them chats where, I don't know, you know, I'm just so lucky to get to spend, you know, an hour a day recording these with just so many creative people, and every now and again you just kind of, you click, and I don't know if that's just because we both got a bit of previous as club promoters, and yeah, I don't know, but yeah, I just felt that, yeah, musically, you know, we had a lot of shared interests, and it makes the conversation, you know, nice and friendly, and just relaxed and loose, and that's what I feel today's natter was. So I hope you got if you got a fraction of the enjoyment listening as I did having that conversation, then my work is done, because that was a real delight, and what a top gent he was. Go give him a follow on all the socials if you don't do so already, and go check out the playlist on Spotify, and get stuck into that, and go check him out at Rough Trade, and support the new record as well. Anyway, I love you and leave you. Thanks ever so much for listening. It's much appreciated. Have a lovely week, and I'll see you next time. Love you. Bye-bye.
It's Off the Beat and Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.